follow on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, I see my job as probably being one of dispelling myths that you might, the sort that you read often in the Evening Standard. So I'm going to try and do that. And what I want to do is just reiterate with this chart. Don't worry if you can't see it. What it does is confirm what's just been said. London has an undersupply, and the paler figures here are projections of future supply. So the story is, supply has never met even minimum targets, except maybe just touch them back in the boom, but it ain't going to going forward either. You know, we've got historic undersupply, and we've got undersupply going forward as well. So if things stay the same, the supply situation is actually going to get worse. We've got a projection that at least if you just follow the economic and employment projections, you need 50,000 units a year, not the current target of 24 or even the mayor's new 40,000. If you want to address the historic undersupply, then I think the London Council's projections are pretty much spot on. Why should we be bothered about undersupply? Well, the consequences on my next slide, I think, are very clear. We've basically created rarity value in London housing. The top line shows prime central London, which is particularly rare, kind of trophy property, if you like, in the very centre where everybody wants to be. And you can see the long-run growth, and this chart goes back to 1979, has been 4.9, nearly 5% above the rate of general inflation. We have created through undersupply a permanent excess inflation. Now, people say there's a housing boom in London. Actually, what's happening now is nothing new. It's just in line with trend. You can see, actually, we've seen some pretty stable growth in prime central London. But the mainstream London is a bit lower than that extreme in the prime, but it's still way above the UK average. So this undersupply is having direct and severe and long-term consequences on affordability. And it isn't going to be fixed overnight. This is a long-term issue. This is a long-run graph. I want to then sort of unpick the nature of the undersupply. So my next slide shows the difference between take-up, which is the pink columns there. Now, of course, take-up isn't demand. There's a lot of take-up that's happened in the past, which are just the people who did manage to buy the houses. There's plenty of people who didn't manage to buy, so don't take this as being demand. But against that, I've set in the light, sort of bluey, greeny-blue, the actual delivery. Now, I've split it up by price band. And the point here is that, first of all, the prime markets, which is what everybody talks about in the Evening Standard, you should barely be concerned with, because it's a very, very low number. And these are exaggerated, they're great headline makers. But they're pretty much, the prime markets are more fully supplied. The real gap is that poor old squeezed middle. It's the most undersupplied is the mid-mainstream sort of market. Still, by most people's standards, pretty expensive at sort of £500 a square foot or whatever. But a three-bedroom flat for £600k isn't exactly, in most people's range. But it's by London standards, that's the middle. And it's that we're undersupplying. And the lower ends, of course, are undersupplied. That means that actually all our concentration on these wealthy buyers in prime London and the foreigners is actually pretty irrelevant. So my next slide just illustrates that when you get to the lower mainstream, basically the yellow is UK buyers, and this is new build. So you can see all those wealthy foreigners are concentrated in the prime markets. They're the rare markets, the undersupplied ones. This is about wealth. Actually, it's not an issue in the mid and lower mainstream. This is a red herring. If you get worked up about foreign buyers coming in and taking stock, you're getting led by the nose by the journalists, dare I say. And what does this foreign investment in London actually mean anyway? Well, it means London's a cosmopolitan city. My next slide shows all the London boroughs. And this is the number of foreign-born residents. You can see, along with Westminster and Kensington and Chelsea, Brent and Newham have over 50% overseas-born buyers. London's a cosmopolitan city. This is part of it. And if you look at that rarefied prime market that everybody talks about the foreign investors, 85% of them live and work in London. You know, this is just part of the London phenomenon. Don't get sidetracked by it. I haven't got time to really go into my next slide in a lot of detail, but what we've tried to do is actually put all these figures about percentages of buyers in context. And first of all, you can see that the new build market, which is what everybody talks about, is actually a very small portion of the market, about a quarter. The blue pies in the bigger chart actually is the resale market. So the new build market is a small area of this prime London. A lot of buyers, especially foreign buyers who buy, do buy for an investment, but that means that the property is let and occupied eventually. It may take a while. There are some voids at the beginning of a large letting scheme, but we could only find evidence for a very small number who are buying second homes, so with lower occupancy levels. So again, don't get too drawn down that route. Now, I want to come on to the sort of the much bigger picture. I think it's very noticeable that we have totally relied on speculative house building to deliver anything, including social housing, because about a third of what gets built by the speculative house builders, about 30%, is social housing. It's the only source of social housing, pretty much, in London or in the UK at the moment. And it seems to me that we have singularly lacked alternative forms of delivery. And if you look at periods in the past that did have high levels of delivery, it was what were then new and novel methods of delivery. If you look at the 1930s, for example, you don't have, of course, we all know about the 1960s and 70s social housing. That's undoubtedly one line of delivery. But go back to the 1930s, and you're talking about a very new and novel method that was of delivering housing for working class people, which built metro land, which was actually funded by building societies. It was virtually a self-help effort. And I think there are many new and novel and interesting ways that we could be looking. And I'm a great believer in self-procurement. It's how 50% of housing on the continent is delivered, basically. So that's a whole area that we just haven't begun to explore. Why do I put this chart up? Well, of course, what it shows is actually that belt of metro land. And what we've done is we've coloured here in red areas that have gentrified, basically, where the quality of jobs has actually risen. And the blue areas show where the quality of jobs over the last decade or so have actually declined. So you've got a story of inner city gentrification. But one thing that's not paid attention to very much is the fact that metro land is de-gentrifying. We're seeing a failure of that. So all the policy effort of the 80s when I started looking at this was on inner city regeneration. And that, to an extent, is working. What we've got to tackle next is the problem, the decline of the outer city. And that's where land supply is. And we talk very little about land supply. And this is a huge challenge because that outer band is individually owner-occupied. The land supplies in the hands of individuals. And what we've failed to do, I think, in the last century is actually create more city. We stopped creating London. People talk about the green belt limiting London's growth. I argue it's this blue collar, if you like. So that this is a different paradigm. This is something new to be tackled, and we haven't even begun to think about. And going on from that, I just want to also point out the potential folly of sticking to London's political boundaries in considering this problem. What this map shows is the influence of London's housing market. What we've measured here is how correlated to London all the other housing markets in the UK are. And what you can see here, that bright red area, there's over a 90% correlation with London's housing market. So what we're saying here is London's housing market extends way beyond its political boundaries. And you mentioned Crossrail. Can we start to consider perhaps that Crossrail is certainly transport improvements might be part of the housing solution? Because this is actually where Londoners live. This is where London's money goes, and this is how it feeds those housing markets around. It's pretty much the whole of the southern part of the country, knock off Norfolk, Cornwall and Devon. So what I want to do is sort of just broaden out the issue to one of thinking about land supply, about new methods and of delivery, and the fact that we can't keep thinking in the same old way about the same old players. Let them do it. I mean, the speculative house builders are the only show in town at the moment. Let them carry on with it. But let's start thinking about how we create more city and start using new methods of finance, planning. Build-to-let, of course, is part of the supply story. But also let's start thinking bigger sort of geographically as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much.